I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. With only 44 members since the 1700s, it's arguably the world's most exclusive fraternity. They are bound forever by a shared experience and yet are rivals for history's favor. We're talking, of course, about the U.S. presidency. Today, the history of the private relationships among modern commanders-in-chief, their backroom deals, rescue missions, secret alliances, and enduring rivalries. Among their secrets, how Jack Kennedy tried to blame Ike for the Bay of Pigs, and how Richard Nixon conspired with Lyndon Johnson to get elected and then betrayed him. This hour, a conversation about these powerful relationships and a powerful influence I have on babies. Just call me the Baby Whisperer. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The world's most exclusive club? That's easy. It has five of the best-known men in the world, each of whom shared a singular responsibility, which was, or is, running the United States of America. A new book, The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity, chronicles the personal and political relationships among America's modern presidents and tells how each relied on the others for advice in ways that changed the course of history. Just one small example, and picture this one, Ronald Reagan teaching Bill Clinton the proper way to salute. The group, believe it or not, has its own clubhouse, and its members have enjoyed good relations with each other, as well as poisonous relations, best exemplified by Richard Nixon and Lyndon Johnson. The book is written by Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy, both editors at Time Magazine, and Nancy Gibbs joins us now from Time's offices in Washington. And Nancy, good morning. So good to have you.
Nice to be with you.
You know, what fascinates me about this book is that we have heard so little, really, about the President's Club over the years, and yet it's so influential. Why haven't we heard more about it?
You know, we wondered that, too. We sort of wondered why no one had told this story before. And, of course, it has been told in bits and pieces. But by and large, I think we tend to look at presidents as these epic individuals. We see them on the global stage one at a time. And so looking at them in pairs or trios or quartets even, and looking at them through their relationships to one another is just a completely different way to view them and to judge them. And so, you know, we thought that it opened up whole new sides of both the individual presidents and of the presidency itself.
You know, how hard was it then to research something that's not received all that much publicity?
Well, fortunately, you know, the presidential libraries, as historians and journalists alike know, are fantastic resources. Mm-hmm. And we were fortunate as well, in addition to sort of the archival material, the oral histories, that the presidents themselves cooperated with us. We spoke with President Bush, President Carter, President Clinton, and you know, the stories that they tell of one another were very surprising to us. And I think that they are not particularly inclined to publicize their fraternity. It is, you know, it is a very small group, as you suggested. It's a very exclusive club. And they are communicating in private about what they should do in public. And that included whether they should talk to us.
Surprising. How surprising? What do you mean by that?
Well, one thing that we were struck by all through the period that we covered, and we started back in 1945, was how often presidents from different parties seem to have an easier time getting along than presidents from the same party.
Huh.
And so, you know, the first relationship that was the one that really got us fascinated in the whole topic between Harry Truman and Herbert Hoover.
That's which such was a great story. Yes.
Completely unexpected and two political opposites. And we're like, okay, if Hoover and Truman can form an alliance, then how surprised should we really be that Eisenhower and Johnson did or that Clinton and Nixon did?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Hoover and Truman because it's a really touching story in a way because, as you point out in this book, Herbert Hoover had not been back, had not stepped foot inside the White House during the entirety of Franklin Roosevelt's administration, Hoover coming right before Franklin Roosevelt. Why did Harry Truman call him up one day and say, come on over, I'm going to send a limo to pick you up?
Well, Truman understood, you know, who obviously took office very suddenly in the spring of 1945 as the war in Europe was ending, that he felt like the world had just fallen in on his head, he told his friends, and that he needed all the help he could get. And he was not about to reject the help of someone who could be valuable just because it might be, you know, politically inconvenient. And so, you know, to the horror of the Roosevelt loyalists in the White House, Truman privately reached out to Hoover. And it was to Hoover because, you know, we often forget, I think, that the way Hoover had first become an American hero was helping Woodrow Wilson managing relief during and after World War I. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what Truman concluded is there was really no one alive who understood better how to do humanitarian relief, how to move food around the world from countries that had it to countries that needed it. And in 1945, you had all of Western Europe with millions of people at risk of starvation because of the complete devastation to the countries. And Hoover was the one guy who Truman knew could help. And that's why he reached out, despite the fact that Hoover had really left office sort of the most hated man in America.
Hey, how did all this impact Herbert Hoover? What did he make of the whole thing? How was he touched by it?
Well, you know, his initial – there's a story that is told about him basically bursting into tears in mm-hmm. the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. What we found in as we dug deeper is that story, while very touching and sweet, is probably not true. Mm. And the reason I say that is because I've read Hoover's diaries and notes of the meeting, and as well as Truman's. And those two men, not surprisingly, went into that meeting and emerged from it still quite suspicious and skeptical of each other and the motives and intentions. Hoover suspected Truman might just be trying to sort of, you know, build bipartisan goodwill. And it really wasn't until Truman acted on the invitation of saying, no, I really do want you to come back in. I really do want you to help. I'm going to give you a plane and a staff and send you around the world meeting with leaders to try to negotiate these deals to move food around and to help with humanitarian relief. You know, in 1946 and 47, Hoover traveled about 50,000 miles around the world on behalf of Harry Truman. It was really when they actually, you know, he put his money where his mouth was and really used him, consulted him, pulled him back into the national spotlight that Hoover realized that, you know, Truman was serious about this.
We're visiting with Nancy Gibbs about her new book, The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. So let me get this straight, Nancy. The presidents have their own clubhouse? Tell me about that.
They do. And my co-author, Michael Duffy, is the first journalist to go inside of it. It is an unmarked townhouse on Lafayette Square in Washington, sort of across the square
across
from
the
White House.
Across the street, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was Richard Nixon who sort of quietly arranged in 1969 for it to become a clubhouse just for the use of former presidents. In Nixon's case, he was looking to keep Lyndon Johnson happy. And so he wanted a place for Johnson to be able to camp out when he came to town. In the end, Johnson ended up not using the clubhouse. The first president to actually stay there was Gerald Ford. But since then, it has been fully renovated in recent years. And so you walk in the door and there's a rug on the floor with the presidential seal on it. And you go into the office and all of the president's papers, the bound volumes of their papers going back to Hoover, are there on the shelves on the wall. Mm. And in the bedrooms upstairs, you know, the bedspreads have the presidential seal embossed in the fabric. So it's, you know, really, it is the world's most exclusive hotel because the only way you can get in is to call the White House to make reservations. And there are only four men alive who have the right to do that.
How often do they use it?
Well, you know, of course, President Bush, 41, I think, has probably used it the most. But there was an 8-year period when he didn't need to, when his son was in the White House. So, you know, I think it's there are obviously other places that they can stay when they're in Washington. But it's handy to have a place that has room for the Secret Service in the basement, is completely sort of private and off the radar, much easier than trying to, you know, stay at a hotel.
We'll return to our conversation with Nancy Gibbs about her new book, The President's Club, in just a moment. We'll talk about how the five members of the club get along today and who the odd man out is of these five. And Welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. We're visiting with Nancy Gibbs of Time Magazine about her new book, The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. You know, Nancy, including President Obama, as I mentioned, there are five members of the club today. How do they tend to get along?
Well, I was struck by the fact that President Obama, very soon after his election in 2008, asked President Bush to basically assemble the entire membership, which had not happened in the White House in decades. But early in January, a couple weeks before the inauguration, Presidents Carter and Clinton and both Bushes and President-elect Obama met for lunch. And, you know, what was remarkable is that this is not an occasion for them to be offering advice about what to do about Afghanistan. You know, President Carter told us, we really talked about what it was like to live in the White House. And, of course, many of that group had raised adolescent girls in the White House, as the Obamas were looking at doing. And one thing that struck me about that is sort of, again, the sort of ritual that this group has is that President Bush said at the time, we all want you to succeed. And whether we're Democrat or Republican, we all understand that the office matters more than the individual. And again through history, we see that playing out. It is not that it's always sweetness and light. There have been some, you know, pretty bitter feuds within this membership. But there are also all of these occasions when, especially in moments of national crisis, where you see a president of one party reaching out in private to help a sitting president of a different party and help in ways that are against personal or political interest, and but are very much meant to be in the national interest. And I think, you know, particularly now when we're at a time when we're really having a pretty intense national conversation about our ability to solve problems, get things done, work together for the good of the country, the example that we saw again and again of presidents of different parties doing this is really sort of heartening and maybe a model for current politicians to follow.
Well, of the five, Nancy, who tends to be the odd man out?
Well, you know, anyone who has seen the famous pictures of that lunch in 2009 will see both Bushes and Clinton and Obama standing together. And then off to the side is Jimmy Carter. And he's literally like physically a step removed. And that's as good a visual metaphor for his role. I think maybe every club needs to have one member that unites them in their hostility is too strong a word, but they all had their challenges in managing Jimmy Carter. Carter himself has said that he is a better ex-president than he was a president. He's had a very active life as a former president and has been very useful to his successors in performing some pretty delicate diplomatic missions overseas that really only a former president can do. But it is also true that he has said publicly that he's a better ex-president than any of them. So you can imagine how that sits with them.
Well, you also have written that they all talk to each other. How often do they talk to each other? And how often has President Obama reached out to his predecessors for advice?
It varies how much they talk. It isn't just that they talk in email. It's that their chiefs of staff do, sometimes daily. As you can imagine, the presidents are continually being approached to endorse a cause or a deal or to get together and appear at some occasion. And so, you know, they consult with each other. And this has always been true. There are very funny letters back and forth about between, you know, Hoover and Truman and Eisenhower about, you know, are you going to do this? Are you going to, you know, accept this event or not? And this still happens. We've seen President Obama reach out most publicly to President Clinton and President George Walker Bush after the earthquake in Haiti, where he asked them to team up to coordinate relief efforts in Haiti. We've seen a more President Carter told us about a much more private outreach where he asked President Carter to perform a delicate mission to North Korea. But he also insisted, Carter was very funny about this, that, you know, Obama, the White House, made him promise that he would not talk publicly about it, wouldn't talk to the press about it, you know, really tried to sort of make him stay on script, partly because in years past, Carter had been known to go off script a bit.
Is there a split, Nancy, between the presidents, between those who serve two terms and those who serve one?
You know, the ultimate vindication, of course, for any president is getting reelected.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I've in conversations I've had with other presidential historians, they sort of joke about who gets to go into the main dining room and who has to stay out in the grill room. And that the one-term president is at something of a disadvantage because they do. This is also inevitable. They all compete for history's favor. And so the president who was turned out of office obviously has a different historical position than the one who was successfully reelected. Having said that, you know, we see right now, if you even look at the two presidents, Bush, one of whom was reelected, one of whom wasn't. And yet I think if you look at sort of the public approval ratings of each of them, George Herbert Walker Bush is held in very high esteem, notwithstanding the fact that he did not win in 1992. And so it is by no means any kind of a guarantee of how history, short-term or long-term, will view them.
You know, you disclose in this book, again, it's The President's Club by Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy, both editors at Time Magazine, about how President Obama actually quizzed Ronald Reagan's team of advisors about how to stay focused and not get pulled into the weeds. What did Reagan's advisors wind up telling President Obama?
Well, this is what's so interesting of one of the ways in which sitting presidents turn to their predecessors, or in this case, since Reagan had died by this time, to his advisors, is just for – it isn't for policy advice. It's very seldom about the specifics of, you know, tax reform. Mm. It is much more about managing your time and your energy and your message. And so what Obama was curious about – and he called in some historians and – you know, people who had worked very closely in the Reagan White House, to ask about how did he manage to sort of stay above the fray, not get pulled down into the weeds of policy debates? How was he able to lay out a vision for the country and stick to it
in a way that Obama
felt was sort of transformational during the 1980s? And, you know, this was, of course, a bone of contention with the Clinton camp, was that Obama indicated many times during the 2008 campaign that he felt that Reagan had really been the transformational figure in the modern age. It's not that Obama agreed with the direction that Reagan had taken the country, but he had been very impressed with his ability just as a leader to lay out a vision and to persuade the country to follow it. And he felt that Clinton's presidency had been something of a missed opportunity and that the ambitions had ended up being too small and the compromises coming too quick. Now, of course, as often happens, now that Obama has been in the job for a couple of years, had to trim his own sails, make his own compromises, you see him both, I think, appreciating Bill Clinton's presidency much more and certainly reaching out to him much more. He has sort of enlisted Clinton as his emeritus campaign coach. He has a new campaign video out that Clinton is really the star of. He appears four times in 17 minutes, which is not, I think, what any of us might have expected to see 4 years ago.
Well, Nancy, speaking of Bill Clinton, you have the scene in the book, and describe it for us, Ronald Reagan teaching Bill Clinton the proper way to salute. What happened
We just love this story.
Yes.
It was after the 92 election, and Clinton goes out to Los Angeles to pay a courtesy call on Ronald Reagan towards the end of November. And, you know, this was not meant to be any kind of a formal visit. It was really just, you know, a polite sort of social get-together. But they're talking in the office, and Reagan tells him, gives him a couple pieces of advice. One of them, which, again, very consistent with what outgoing and former presidents tell the new guy, you got to use Camp David. You have to rest. You have to get out of Washington. You have to take care of your physical health. They all, one way or another, are warning them, this job is very punishing, and you have to, you know, monitor your physical health and your rest, and Camp David is a valuable resource. But then the other thing Reagan told him is, you know, having watched Clinton through the campaign, he said, you don't know how to perform a proper military salute. Of course, Clinton had never served in the military, famously. Reagan had not only been a cavalry officer, he had played one in many movies. And so he shows him, you know, about how you're meant to raise your hand slowly, but then bring it down quickly and sharply. And what he was trying to communicate as a former actor, as well as a former president, was how important it is to perform the role as well as to inhabit the office. And so the two men end up standing there in the office, you know, practicing their salutes.
What a great image. What a great image. Well, Nancy, hang on just for a few minutes. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about her new book, The President's Club, and talk about the poisonous relations between Richard Nixon and LBJ. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's discussion with the man who discovered Lucy, the world's most famous fossil, you'll find that plus all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, the past, present, and future of Kansas City's Lyric Opera. Plus, a National Geographic photographer talks about his near-death experience with a Chinese cobra. Well, this hour we're visiting with Nancy Gibbs. She's co-author of The President's Club, the new book that examines the relationships between our presidents in office and out of office, coming up just a bit later. And you might find this hard to believe, a conversation about an 8.5-month-old baby who just loves the sound of my voice. That coming up later on this hour. Well, Nancy Gibbs, has every president reached out to former presidents? Has that been a universal tendency, or have some resisted the idea?
Well, you know, we really traced it in the modern age when, because of, among other things, the telephone and, you know, air travel, yeah, it became more possible for both for presidents to communicate with each other and, frankly, to help each other. You know, we live in an age where a former president is a global celebrity. And so, you know, in through much of American history, there was not a whole lot a former president could really do, unless he, you know, took a new job, like running for Congress, or in the case of William Howard Taft, becoming, you know, Supreme Court Chief Justice. Mm-hmm. So, but in the modern age, pretty much, other than Eisenhower, who really did not feel like he had much that he needed to learn from Hoover or Truman, and of course his relationship with Truman had gone well south by the time Eisenhower took office. Pretty much all the others, either for personal or political reasons or both, did reach out to the men who came before.
What was the problem between Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower? Because I've written about that relationship here for the newspaper, and boy, it did go south, and it went south in just a horrible way.
Well, what's so interesting to me, and it's true of many of these relationships, is that there is a long arc, and it can often be a twisting and turning one. In the case of Truman and Eisenhower, they meet very soon after Truman became president, and Eisenhower had just, you know, accepted the German surrender. He is truly the savior of the Western world and a, you know, immense hero. Eisenhower comes back to Washington, and a million people come out to see him. And, you know, Truman was almost as sort of hero worshipful as Eisenhower as anyone. And through Truman's presidency, they worked very closely together. Eisenhower became the chief of staff of the army. Truman enlisted him to help reorganize the military, to persuade a skeptical Republican Congress about the whole idea of NATO and of sort of collective security. Eisenhower and Truman were a very potent partnership in the post-war years, to the point in 1948 that Truman offered to, if Eisenhower wanted to run for president himself, Truman said, not only will I get out of your way, I'll be your vice president. So you start from that baseline going into the 1952 election, and then it just all comes apart. And it comes apart around, as was so true of so many things, around Senator Joe McCarthy. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he was really approaching the height of his power and denouncing communists in every corner. And among those that he denounced was Secretary of State George Marshall, right, who was a hero of both Truman's and Eisenhower's. And Truman felt that Eisenhower had just completely failed to stand up to McCarthy and was appalled by this. And so as that campaign unfolded, Truman started saying, you know, I liked Ike. I trusted him. I thought I knew him. I thought he'd be a good president. But he has betrayed everything I thought he stood for. And he's a moral coward. Hmm. And so you can imagine how, you know, the Eisenhower camp took this. And in some ways, the 52 campaign, even though it was ostensibly about Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson, was really about Eisenhower and Harry Truman. And by the end of it, it was so bitter between them that when it came time for Inauguration Day, Eisenhower initially refused to go to the White House to pick up Truman.
It was that bad. Yeah.
It was that bad. It was that bad. And, you know, throughout Eisenhower's presidency, Truman did not step foot back in the White House. Now, you could think that's the end of the story, but it really doesn't work that way. You know, once Eisenhower is out of office and is now a former president himself and learned everything that you've learned by that time, he has occasion to reach out to Truman very sort of carefully at first to talk about their presidential libraries. They find themselves, ironically, together at George Marshall's funeral.
Mm-hmm.
They're seated together there. But what really brings about a reconciliation is the next time they're together at a funeral, which was at John F. Kennedy's funeral. And they rode back together in a limousine from Arlington Cemetery after the burial. And, of course, at this point, the assassination of a president does have a way of, you know, concentrating the mind. And so Truman turns to Ike and says, you know, you want to come up for a drink?
Hmm.
And Eisenhower said, sure. And they end up going back to Blair House, the presidential guest house. And as the evening falls, the two men are sitting and reminiscing.
Yes.
And, you know,
yes,
the very few people in the room are watching this and sort of watching the hatchet be buried. And, of course, it was in the shadow of the death of a president that that was possible.
Nancy, let's go really quick here with just a few other relationship pairings between the president. Just give me two or three, four words to describe LBJ and Richard Nixon.
Well, we refer to them as two scorpions in a bottle.
Man.
Here you have two of the most masterful connivers. They were a well-matched pair, and boy, did they fight a bitter war against each other.
Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter.
Most unlikely brothers. Started out intensely disliking each other in the 76 campaign, and they end up both describing the other as like a brother to me.
Bill Clinton and the two presidents, Bush.
The Bush family now has a nickname for Bill Clinton. They call him their brother from another mother.
Somehow that's not too surprising. Nancy, thanks so much for taking the time today. I sure enjoyed having you today.
Steve, it was very nice to be with you. Thanks for letting me come.
All the best. Nancy Gibbs, along with Michael Duffy, is author of The President's Club.